Now we want to get back to Jeremiah. We're in major prophets class and picking up with chapter 37. And chapters 37 and 38 seem to go together. And I say seem to because different scholars will look at it, seeing where Jeremiah is put in prison. Some scholars say, oh, there's two separate imprisonments with a period of freedom in between. Others say, no, it's one long imprisonment and different stuff is going on. So we don't have to know. We do understand we're getting to the time of the end for the nation of Judah. And we pick that up in chapter 37. And King Zedekiah, the son of Josiah, reigned instead of Coniah. Coniah is the one whose name was changed to Jehoiakim, and then he was taken away. So Nebuchadnezzar, we see in verse 1, made Zedekiah king. But as it says in verse 2, neither he nor his servants nor the people of the land gave heed to the words of the Lord spoken by Jeremiah. So Jeremiah has been preaching God's word all along. The king and the people aren't really paying attention. But still, they're aware that this Jeremiah guy seems to have a connection to God. We see in verse 3 that Zedekiah sends someone to Jeremiah saying, pray now to the Eternal our God for us. I think it's kind of funny because you see that sometimes people that know they're not close to God will ask other people to pray for them, thinking maybe God pays more attention to them. You know, it's not wrong to ask someone to pray for you, but if you're asking them to pray for you because you don't know how to do it yourself, that's not the best. Yeah, John?
Yeah, I just remember we jumped to 45, right?
We jumped to 45 and now back. So
then back. So didn't Jeremiah go into hiding?
Yeah, and that was earlier.
Okay, so he's like come out of hiding?
Yeah, remember that was when Jehoiakim was king. Now we're to Zedekiah. So to be honest, we don't know how long he was in hiding. I'm glad you brought it up because I wasn't going to say it because I don't know. He was in hiding for a time. Apparently sometime the heat cooled and he could come out, you know. I say that as though like a bank robber. He goes, hides at the hideout waiting for the posse to dissipate and then they come out and rob another one. By the way, Jeremiah never robbed a bank that anybody knows of. So this chapter is considerably later in years than the story we just covered most recently. Again, it's jumping back and forth. But we're at the time now Zedekiah is king. Zedekiah's asking, you know, he sends a message saying, pray for us. Then we jump ahead. Verse 4, Jeremiah was coming and going among the people. They hadn't yet put him in prison. And Pharaoh's army came up from Egypt. When the Chaldeans who were besieging Jerusalem heard news of them, they departed from Jerusalem. So if I could illustrate, imagine we've got the city of Jerusalem. Imagine there's towers and stuff and a wall. And the army of the Babylonian army is here. But there's an army coming in, the Egyptians, so the Babylonians break camp and go to fight the Egyptians. You know, we don't want to be attacked from behind while we're focusing on the city. So they go to face the Egyptians. The people in the city are like, hey, look, they're taking off. Maybe everything's fine. Maybe God changed his mind. You know, the Babylonians are leaving. And it's in that context that God sends a message through Jeremiah. We see in verse 6, thus says the Lord, going into verse 7, say to the king of Judah who sent you to me to inquire, behold, Pharaoh's army which has come up to help you, it'll return to Egypt to its own land. And the Chaldeans will come back and fight against the city. So the approach of the Egyptians and the Babylonians, or Chaldeans, if you will, we can use those terms interchangeably. They break camp to go against the Egyptians. God has Jeremiah tell him, that's not changing anything. The Egyptians are going to turn around and go back. The Babylonians are going to come back here, and they are going to conquer the city. Okay, so that message is there. We'll leave that and drop down to verse 11. Because something's going to happen while the besieging army is gone. You know, the Babylonians are gone. So it says, you know, the Chaldeans left the siege for fear of Pharaoh's army. Verse 12, Jeremiah left Jerusalem to go to the land of Benjamin to claim his property. Remember, he's from the town of Anathoth. And that's not far from Jerusalem, but it's in the territory of Benjamin. It's worth remembering the territory of Judah and territory of Benjamin are right beside each other. And Jerusalem is right by that line. So he's not going clear across the country. But he's going out. Now, why is he going there? It says to claim his property. Well, we don't know exactly. Some people think, well, he wants to go get the property that's in his family. Maybe a relative died and he's going to claim this is my inheritance. We don't know for sure, but on his way out, in verse 13, he was in the gate of Benjamin. A captain of the guard there saw him and he sees Jeremiah saying, you're defecting to the Chaldeans. Jeremiah, you're turning traitor. You're going to join the enemy. And Jeremiah says, false. Nobody says false. He'd say, no, I'm not. A more modern translation might say that. Said, I'm not defecting. But they wouldn't listen to him, so they brought him in and they put him on trial. It says in verse 15, they struck him and put him in prison. I think there's a great irony in this, and I'll tell you the irony after I answer Austin's question.
This has nothing to do with Jeremiah chapter 32, where he has to like buy a field in the land of Benjamin, does it?
There's some speculation of that, but probably not, because it seems that, if you remember, that happened in the 10th year of Zedekiah, in the last year. And it seems that the army of the Egyptians left and came back, that it would have been before that. But that's not 100% certain. So there are some people reading it come to that conclusion, and others say, no, the timing doesn't seem right. So actually, I have it in my notes to list that as a suggestion, but I've stopped doing it because I'm not sure the timing fits that. But it still could. Either way, the irony is they accuse Jeremiah of going to join the Babylonians, and he never did, even though he advised others that they should do that. You know, it's in his message, look, go join the Chaldeans and you'll live. Stop fighting against them. God is giving them the victory. You go join their side. But Jeremiah couldn't do that because God gave him a job there in Jerusalem. He had to stay there and be a prophet to those people. So he wasn't allowed to do the thing he was telling other people to do, yet that's what he was accused of. And of course, if he's going around telling people that's what they should do, no wonder they came to that conclusion. Hey, you've been telling people to defect. You must be defecting. No, I'm not. But they strike him. They put him in jail. And then in verse 17, it's kind of amusing. And I've got a note. As we've seen with the story of Joseph, sometimes God lets bad things happen to his people. Think of John the Baptist. John the Baptist was put in prison and he got his head chopped off for doing what, you know, God's will. Now, Jeremiah is not going to have that happen. God had promised him protection. Zedekiah, in verse 17, takes him out secretly. Come here, you know, don't let anybody see. And he says, is there word from the Lord? I can imagine, Jeremiah, is there any word from God? Yeah, there is. You're going to die. Actually, it's not that Zedekiah is going to die, but it is the Babylonians will conquer the city. Nothing's changed. Yeah, John?
Is Zedekiah a better king than Jehoiakim?
That's a good question. Zedekiah is not called a good king. I describe him as a waffler. He flip-flops. He'll say, oh, maybe I better check with Jeremiah. Let's see if God will do something good for us. And then, oh, no, the nobles want me to punish Jeremiah, so I'll throw him in prison. Well, maybe I better check again. It's like he can't decide what's right. He's not a strong person, it seems. Yes, Justin?
Is this the same Zedekiah that's the theoretical descendant of Perez, the son of...
Yes.
Okay.
Yeah. And we say all the kings are. Okay, So the word from Jeremiah, verse 17, you'll be delivered into the hand of the king of Babylon. But he speaks up. And again, let's give Jeremiah credit. Here he's showing some courage and determination. He doesn't soften the message. You know, he's not worried, well, Zedekiah is going to be mean to me if I tell him the truth. He's past that. That's the way he would have felt when he was younger. Now he's saying, no, they're going to conquer you. There's no getting out. He says, what offense have I committed against you? This is in verse 18. He says, where now are your prophets who said the king of Babylon wouldn't come here? He's saying, they're the ones that should be in prison. They're the ones that told you lies. My predictions have come true. It doesn't do him much good, but he does ask in verse 20, hear now, O Lord, please let my petition be accepted. Don't make me return to the house of Jonathan the scribe, lest I die there. Don't send me back into that prison. And Zedekiah listened. He commanded that they should commit Jeremiah to the court of the prison. So he's in an area, he's confined, but he's not in a dungeon, and make sure they give him food, a piece of bread from the baker's street until all the city was gone. Thus Jeremiah remained in the court of the prison. Okay, we move on though. Verse 38. I'm going to skim across this. We see a bunch of names that are hard to pronounce, and basically they're saying, they go to Zedekiah and say, why should we let Jeremiah stay alive? He's weakening the fighters because he keeps saying we're going to lose. Get rid of this guy. Put him to death. It says in verse 4, let this man be put to death, for he weakens the hands of the men of war who fight in the city. Verse 5, Zedekiah says, well, he's in your hand. The king can do nothing against you. Once again, he's kind of a flip-flopper. Maybe he doesn't feel he's strong enough to resist them, or he doesn't want to spend his political capital on Jeremiah. You know, we don't know, but As I said, he's not standing up for him. So, verse 6, they take Jeremiah and cast him in the dungeon of Malchiah, the king's son, which is in the court of the prison. So it's nearby. They let Jeremiah down with ropes. And in the dungeon, there was no water but mire. What's mire? It's muck. It's probably soft mud or silt. And he says he sinks down into it. Most people think this was probably a cistern, like a place carved out and lined, made to hold water, but there's no water in it, and it's used over the years, so there's enough silt and gunk at the bottom that it's icky, yucky, you know. So poor Jeremiah, they let him down here. It's probably dark. There's not an electric light switch. He's just in there, sunk in, and he's probably thinking, okay, here's where I'm going to die. You know, God promised me protection, but I don't see it. We're not sure about his thought. But God is going to bring protection. In verse 7, we see Ebed-Melech the Ethiopian. We want to remember this name because he does something pretty brave and God will promise him something for it. So Ebed-Melech says he's an Ethiopian, so he's not an Israelite, but he's of some position there. He's one of the eunuchs, or that could be translated officers, in the king's house. He heard what they did to Jeremiah. So Ebed-Melech goes to the king and says, "Yeah, king, you know, you said that he was in their hands, but look what they did. They put him in there, and he's going to starve to death. He's in this dungeon. There's no more bread." So the king said, "Okay, take these 30 men and go get him out." So Ebed-Melech gets these men, gets ropes. He gets some old clothes, some stuff, because when you're sunk down in mire, it's hard to get out. Have you guys ever lost a boot or a shoe when you step in the mud? So he said, "Put the stuff under your armpits for the ropes, because so the ropes don't jerk your arms off." And they pull Jeremiah up out. You know, good for Ebed-Melech. He gets permission to do it, and he saves Jeremiah's life. Now, I'll make a note, because it comes a little bit later, but it's in chapter 39, near the end of the chapter. But basically, verses 15 through 18 is where God has Jeremiah give a personal prophecy to Ebed-Melech, saying, "I'm going to protect your life. Because of what you did, Ebed-Melech, people are going to die around you, but your life will be a prize." Now, how many people have we got God promising protection in the fall of Jerusalem? Three. Who? Baruch, Jeremiah, and Ebed-Melech. It's worth noting because a lot of people are going to die. Well, not everybody. Some other people will live, but these people have that personal protection. I mean, how would you like to have that? I'd love to have God say, "Frank, no matter what happens, you're going to live through it." I'd be tempted to take chances maybe that I shouldn't. Yes, Kira?
Where does it give him that promise?
Sorry. It's in the end of chapter 39. So I just referenced ahead, chapter 39, verses 15 through 18. But before we get to that, we can look back in chapter 38, because now, okay, Jeremiah is not in the muck anymore. He's still in prison. In verse 14, Zedekiah sends and has Jeremiah brought again. Okay, I want to meet with him. And so he says, "I'll ask you something. Don't hide it from me." Jeremiah says, "Well, if I tell you, aren't you going to put me to death? And if I give you advice, you're not going to listen." So Jeremiah basically saying, "I'm not going to talk to you unless you promise you won't kill me." And verse 16, Zedekiah does. He swears, "As the Lord lives who made our souls, I won't put you to death. I won't give you over into the hand of these men who seek you." Verse 17, then Jeremiah says, "Well, okay, here's the word. Thus says the Lord God of hosts, if you surrender to the king of Babylon's princes, your soul shall live, and the city won't be burned with fire." So at this late hour, with the promise of destruction, Jeremiah is saying, God's willing to give you an out. You have to surrender to Babylon. You know, we could say Daniel interpreted the dream of Nebuchadnezzar with the great statue. Nebuchadnezzar is the head of gold. You know, he's the lion with wings. We're starting this cycle of these great empires. But you don't have to die, and the city here doesn't have to be burned. You can surrender. If you surrender, you've got an out. But if you don't, verse 18, if you do not surrender to the king of Babylon's princes, this city will be given into the hand of Chaldeans, and they will burn it with fire, and you shall not escape. That's pretty strong. What does Zedekiah say? "Well, I'm afraid of the Jews who defected. They might abuse me." I'm not sure if he said it quite like that, but he's afraid of the Jews who are already siding with the Chaldeans. "I'm afraid if I surrender, they're going to get me." Jeremiah answers, verse 1, they won't deliver you. Just obey the voice of God, and it'll be okay with you. If you refuse to surrender, this is the word the Lord has shown me. You know, and he goes on to describe death and destruction. And Zedekiah, you know, Zedekiah kind of flip-flops. He seems like he's almost willing to go along with it, and then he doesn't. He says, well, don't tell any of the princes that we talked. So Zedekiah is worried about these other noblemen, people of position and authority. If they come and ask you what he said, just tell them that you asked me not to send you back to prison. And Jeremiah has asked him not to send him back to prison, so that gives him an out to answer honestly and not tell about the rest of what they discussed. You know, I'm portraying Zedekiah as going back and forth. Oh, maybe I believe Jeremiah, maybe I don't, maybe I should do this. There's another perspective that's worth thinking, because we read about when he asked Jeremiah, what does Yahweh say? But we don't know if maybe he's going to another prophet and saying, well, what does Baal say? And to this guy, what does Chemosh say? Well, I'm going to go over and check with this guy. What does Dagon say? It's possible that Zedekiah is checking with all these different religions to cover his bases. Now, I'm saying possible. That's pure speculation on my part. And not just mine. I've read it from other sources. But, you know, maybe, maybe not. I'd prefer to think that Zedekiah only believes in one God and he's just weak in that. But it's hard to say. Either way, he's not going to follow through. He's not going to do what the true God says to do. He leaves Jeremiah in the court of prison, and we move into chapter 39, which will describe the actual fall of the city, the conquest of the kingdom of Judah. And let me give you some references. There are other places in the Bible that describe this. 2 Kings chapter 25 describes the fall of Jerusalem. That was 2 Kings 25. Also 2 Chronicles chapter 36. And, not coincidentally, Jeremiah chapter 52. Jeremiah 52 is pretty much word for word the same as is in 2 Kings 25. So we've got pretty good accounts of Jerusalem falling. And, of course, Jeremiah chapter 39 gives it from this particular perspective. We back up. It says, in the ninth year of Zedekiah, in the tenth month, so near the end of the ninth year of Zedekiah, Nebuchadnezzar comes and besieges Jerusalem. And in the 11th year, in the fourth month, the city was penetrated. They broke through the walls and or the gates, and they got in. So the siege took a bit less than 2 years. You know, we could count up the months, you know, and so they do this. And it says the military captains of the Babylonians came in to celebrate. You know, they came, and it mentions the Nergal Sharezer, Samgar Nebo, Sarsakim, Rabsaris, and Nergal Sharezer, and Rabmag. These guys should all be in the Lord of the Rings with those names. But it says they come in and they sit in the gate of the city, the middle gate. So it's sort of like when Hitler conquered Paris and he marched his soldiers right through the Arch of Triumph or Arc de Triomphe, sort of to show off, we're here, we conquered it. While this is going on in verse 4, Zedekiah the king and the men of war saw it and they fled. Basically, they snuck out a secret way. So the Babylonians are coming in, they've conquered the city. Zedekiah and some of his top guys try to escape, and they do, they flee. But the Babylonians come after him, and they catch up with him. Verse 5, on the plains of Jericho, they caught him, captured him, and brought him back up to Nebuchadnezzar. Here's where we'll see the prophecy fulfilled. Back in chapter 32, verse 4, it said that, Zedekiah, you're going to see Nebuchadnezzar face to face. Your eyes are going to look at his eyes, and we see it here happening. They brought him to Nebuchadnezzar. And Nebuchadnezzar does something particularly cruel at this time. He's going to purposely extinguish Zedekiah's dynasty. Now, that doesn't mean all the descendants of the kingly line, because there are a lot of descendants of King David, but Zedekiah's sons. And he does it in a cruel way. In verse 6, the king of Babylon killed the sons of Zedekiah before his eyes, made him watch. And then it says in verse 7, he put out Zedekiah's eyes. So Zedekiah is going to be blind for the rest of his life, but the last thing he ever saw was his sons being killed. That's pretty harsh. That's tough. But that's, remember, Nebuchadnezzar was a mean, tough guy. I think you probably got that impression from the class on Daniel. And he's going to be bound in bronze fetters, carried off to Babylon. You know, we'll see, Zedekiah is taken prisoner, but he does not die right away. The prophecy later said he'd die in peace. He'll die a captive, but not in battle. And later, I'll mention this. This appears in 2 Chronicles 36 and verse 23. 2 Chronicles 36, 23. And it's also in Jeremiah 52 that the previous king, before Zedekiah, his uncle Jehoiakim had been taken captive after only reigning 3 months. Well, he's still alive in Babylon. And years later, when Nebuchadnezzar's dead, one of his descendants gets Jehoiakim out of prison, changes his garments, and has him eat at his table. So he starts treating him nice. We don't have a real explanation, but there's some speculation on why that would happen. And one of it has to do with the fact that Zedekiah's sons are all dead, but we'll see later references to the king's daughters. The king's daughters were not killed in front of his eyes. We'll see as soon as chapter 41, verse 10. 41:10 is the first reference of the king's daughters, and also 43, verse 6. I've mentioned already, it's not a surprise, you know, this idea that one of the king's daughters married into a royal family when they got to Ireland. One speculation is that Jehoiakim was kept alive so David would have someone to rule at least until that king's daughter had a son of her own. But there's no proof and no reference in the Bible of that. But it's a thought of how the promise could specifically be fulfilled. At any rate, we go through chapter 30. The Chaldeans, this is verse 8, the Chaldeans burned the king's house. Nebuchadnezzar the guard carried away captive to Babylon the remnant of the people and those who defected with the rest of the people. Verse 10, now not every person goes. Nebuzaradan, the captain of the guard, left in the land of Judah the poor people who had nothing and gave them vineyards and fields. It's interesting, we don't have solid numbers. You know, some people are taken away to Babylon. Some people are left here. It seems that those numbers are both probably relatively small. What we don't have is how many people are just plain dead because the Babylonian army killed them. That's probably the large majority. But we know there are survivors. Survivors taken to Babylon. Some survivors left there. And where's Jeremiah in all this? Last we saw him, he's in prison. You know, Zedekiah came and consulted with him. Verse 11 of chapter 39. Nebuchadnezzar, king of Babylon, gave charge concerning Jeremiah. So he said, gives a charge to Nebuzaradan, the captain of the guard. So Nebuchadnezzar tells one of his top guys, go find Jeremiah. Go find him and take care of him. And do just as he says to you. I want Jeremiah to be okay. We could ask, how does Nebuchadnezzar know anything about Jeremiah? And Jeremiah is not an unknown person necessarily, so maybe it's not a big stretch, but it's sort of curious. One thought is Nebuchadnezzar probably has spies. Every king has spies spying on whatever kingdoms he can, and he's hearing what Jeremiah is telling the people, surrender, defect. No, Nebuchadnezzar would like that. So maybe, you know, he's inclined to show favor to Jeremiah just because of what he's heard. But let's think also, who has become one of Nebuchadnezzar's top advisors back home in Babylon? A fellow that you might have heard of named Daniel, you know, and Nebuchadnezzar respects him. Now, this is pure speculation, but we might say maybe God had Daniel tell Nebuchadnezzar to look out for this guy named Jeremiah. There's a big maybe attached to that, but it's not a stretch to think that it could be. John, you had to...
So then why didn't Daniel just say, don't attack them at all? Like, wouldn't he have had that persuasion?
Well, it was God's purpose to have Judah conquered. You know, basically God let him know, this is what's happening, this is the plan I'm going with. It wasn't God's purpose to spare Judah. He gave them an opportunity to not have all those people die if they would surrender and participate in the plan.
How did Daniel know about Jeremiah?
Well, I'm just speculating. Perhaps God could have told him, but maybe not at all. I said the more easy or the simplest idea is that Nebuchadnezzar's spies told him of the messages of Jeremiah, and he's saying, hey, that guy's on my side. I'm going to give him a reward. And that's what happens in verse 14. It says, they sent someone to take Jeremiah from the court of the prison, committed him to Gedaliah. Now, that makes it sound like they took him directly out of prison. But later on, it reveals that he'd gone with the prisoners as far as Ramah in chapter 40, verse 1. And Nebuzaradan, the captain of the guard, had let him go from Ramah when he had taken him bound in chains among all who were carried away captive. So Jeremiah is in chains with captives like with everyone else. Ramah, remember, is not far away. That's where Rachel wept for her children. We saw in a prophecy earlier. So they find him. There's the Jeremiah. Get those chains off of him. We got to let him go. But before we get to that, I already mentioned, well, there's a couple of things we want to mention. Sorry. Back in chapter 39, we'll catch up with Jeremiah in a moment. There's a mention of Gedaliah. We want to know who Gedaliah is. Gedaliah is going to be appointed governor. We'll see that in chapter 40. I'm just mentioning it here. So Jeremiah is committed to him. But before even that happens, God gives a message to Jeremiah to find Ebed-Melech and give him the message that we saw at the end of chapter 39. Hey, Ebed-Melech, God says, because you did this thing, like you got me out of the muck and mire and saved my life. Verse 17, I will deliver you in that day, and you shall not be given into the hand of the men of whom you're afraid. Verse 18, I will surely deliver you, and you shall not fall by the sword. Your life shall be a prize to you because you put your trust in me. So God's saying, Ebed-Melech, you got your priorities right. You're trusting me. I'm going to protect you. Now let's get back to Jeremiah. We saw in chapter 40, verse 1, he'd been in chains. The captain of the guard frees him. Verse 2, we see a little conversation. The captain of the guard said, the Lord your God has pronounced this doom on this place. Now the Lord has done it. And he's done just as he said, because you disobeyed the voice of him. So now, blah, blah. Verse 4, now look, I free you from the chains that were on your hands. If it seems good to you, come with me to Babylon. I'll look after you. But if that seems wrong for you to come to Babylon, look, the land is before you. Wherever it seems good and convenient, go ahead and go. So Jeremiah's got it great. And it also will say he gave him a gift, meaning here's some money. You're free. You can come with me and have a nice life in Babylon or wherever you want to go. Jeremiah, you are a free man. That's what the Babylonians tell Jeremiah. But is Jeremiah free to go wherever he wants yet? No, he's still working for God, and God's not done with his mission. So Jeremiah doesn't just take off. You know, if he were totally free, he'd hop on a boat and go to Hawaii and hang out there, if he knew where Hawaii was. But no. Verse 5, Jeremiah had not yet gone back in Nebuzaradan. Said, go back to Gedaliah, the son of Ahikam, whom the king of Babylon has made governor, and dwell with him. And verse 6, Jeremiah went to Gedaliah. It doesn't say that God told him to, but it's pretty certain that he did. So Gedaliah is governor. What's the difference between a governor and a king? And we don't have to have a technical thing, but Zedekiah was king. He ruled over the country. It was an office by descent. Gedaliah is appointed. He derives his power from Babylon. He's working for Nebuchadnezzar. He's Nebuchadnezzar's agent. Okay, so he's put there by Nebuchadnezzar, and Judah is no longer a kingdom. Judah is now a province within the Babylonian Empire. That's important for people to remember. And Gedaliah is okay with that. It's interesting, now there's kind of peace. And verse 7 says, when all the captains of the armies who were in the field, they and their men, heard that the king of Babylon made Gedaliah governor in the land and committed to him the men, women, children who were poor. Verse 8, then they, these captains of the armies or captains of forces, I like the old King James said, they came to Gedaliah at Mizpah. We also want to be aware of Mizpah because this was Jerusalem and it's gone. It's been destroyed. So now we're going to this tiny little town called Mizpah. And that's now the seat of the government. So it's in the suburbs. It's like, say, Cincinnati has been destroyed, so now Milford is where the area is being governed from. That's probably not the best comparison, but yes, John?
These captains, are they of the Israelite army or the Babylonian army?
Israelite army.
Okay.
And what we see here is, well, Micah, was Mizpah the place where Saul was first ordained king? I don't remember, but that sounds right to me. You know, it's a town that's been around quite a long time and it's established, so. But I'd have to double check to make sure. But if your memory says it is, then I wouldn't necessarily disagree with it. These captains of forces, imagine as the Babylonians are overrunning the city and the army's being defeated, some captains might lead their band of men and go into hiding. And so they're like, you know, this armed mercenaries. Now we're looking out for ourselves. You know, and there's quite a few of these. When I first read this, I thought of, if you've ever seen Mad Max, you know, the movie after the post-apocalypse, and there's these groups out there riding on motorcycles and whatever vehicles they can find, and they're None of you guys have ever seen Mad Max? And I know there's a newer version of it that I didn't see. So I saw the old one with Mel Gibson. Yeah, as I said, why couldn't I think of Mel Gibson? I was thinking of Braveheart. But anyway, so there's these different groups that they've been in hiding. But now the Babylonian army's withdrawing. There's only a garrison here or there. And so they come out and they gather to the governor. Okay. And there's some names worth noting, especially Johanan. He's one of prominence. He's not the only one, but we're going to see him step up and do some things. But Johanan and Jonathan, sons of Korea, and Sariah, and Netophathite, you know, they and their men. So in verse 9, Gedaliah takes an oath, and he says to all the people, don't be afraid to serve the Chaldeans. Okay, the Chaldeans are in charge now. I work for them, but we're cool. Settle down. He said, look, you got all these fields and there's crops in the field. So let's do this. Serve the Chaldeans. Verse 10, as for me, I'll dwell in Mizpah and serve the Chaldeans who come to us. But you guys, go gather wine and summer fruit and oil. Put them in your vessels. So there's crops in the field. Look, let's not starve. Go get to work. Start harvesting the crop and find a place to live and set yourself up. You know, we're just the poor people left of the land, and there's not many of us, so let's do this. Okay, we see in verse 11, likewise, when the Jews who were in Moab among the Ammonites and Edom, when all the countries heard that the king of Babylon left a remnant in Judah, they came, in verse 12, they returned out of their places. So we've got, you know, Jerusalem is here, the Babylonians have been here, so some of the Jews took off and they were hiding over here, they're hiding down here, they're hiding here. Now the word gets to them. They're not watching it on CNN. They're not checking their news feed on Facebook or whatever. They got to wait for somebody to show up and say, hey, have you heard the news? Jerusalem has been conquered. But Nebuchadnezzar left a governor at Mizpah, and things are okay now. And so some people say, well, I'm going to go back. And so people start filtering back in. How many people? I don't know. It doesn't seem like it's a huge number, but the numbers are growing. It's a size that it's worth reckoning with. But it's a size that can be handled. And we've got another problem. Verse 13, Johanan of Korea, the captains of the forces are in the field. They came to Gedaliah. So these captains of forces, you know, I've got my own band, you've got their band. They come to Gedaliah and say, we got news. Do you know that Baalis, the king of the Ammonites, sent Ishmael to murder you? So where the king of Ammon is over here. The Ammonites are here. He said, hey, this guy that's coming to see you, he's not your friend. He's going to pretend like it, but he's coming to kill you. He's working for the king of Ammon. Gedaliah, be careful. What does Gedaliah say? Well, at first, in verse 15, Johanan, remember, he's some guy of significance. Let me go take care of Ishmael. I'll kill him and no one will know. Well, we don't want to let him murder you. You're the guy in charge now. We trust you. We need you to stick around. Let me go get rid of Ishmael. Verse 16, Gedaliah says, don't do that. That's not true about Ishmael. I don't believe that. Don't go kill him. He is our friend. Who do you believe in this situation? Well, if you're like me and you've read the next couple chapters, you already know. Well, it comes to pass, moving into chapter 41. I'm going to come back and re-summarize the story so hopefully we can get a clearer view of the narrative. But I want to go through it in scripture first. It says in the seventh month, Ishmael did come, the royal and Ishmael, son of Elishama of the royal family. It's worth noting, we don't have to go back there, but he's mentioned back in 2 Kings 25 and verse 25. 2 Kings 25, 25 tells us Ishmael was actually a descendant of King David. He's not like next in line for the throne, but he's one of, you know, remember there's quite a few descendants of David around. He's working for the king of Ammon, but there's some speculation. Maybe he's thinking, hey, why wasn't I made governor instead of Gedaliah? You know, I'm descended from David. We don't know if that's the case. You know, maybe he's just in it for the money. But he does come, and in verse 2, it tells us he struck Gedaliah with the sword and killed him. Killed him whom the king of Babylon had made governor. That's very important. It's not just that he killed someone. He's probably killed a lot of people. He's this mercenary guy. But he killed Nebuchadnezzar's guy. Nebuchadnezzar's not going to be happy about that. And he goes further. At the end of verse 3, it says, also the Chaldeans, the men of war that were there. So Nebuchadnezzar left a garrison of Chaldean troops. and Ishmael killed them too. What do you think? We would call this an act of war. Nebuchadnezzar conquered Judah and Jerusalem, set up his government. Now someone comes in and kills my guys. I might have to bring my army back and take care of business. And I'm saying that because the people, when they find out that Gedaliah is dead, are going to be scared witless. You know, oh no, what do we do now? The Babylonians will come back. There's a little inset story here that follows on in verse 5. These men are coming from different places, from Shechem. Shechem has a long history going back to Genesis 34. From Shiloh, from Samaria, there's 80 men coming to Jerusalem. And we don't know, maybe they don't know all the news, but it says they have their beard shaved, their clothes torn, so they're in mourning to bring an offering to the house of the Lord. They're coming to bring something to the temple. Apparently, they don't know there is no temple anymore. But Ishmael goes out and meets them, weeping as he went along. And Ishmael, who, by the way, just killed Gedaliah, says, oh, come on, come to Gedaliah. He's going to take care of you. You know, he's lying through his teeth to get him in, get him vulnerable, and then he starts killing them all. So he's killing this 80 men and throwing them in this pit. Now, in verse 8, says 10 of them said, well, don't kill us. We've got treasures of wheat and oil and honey in the field. Says, well, I'll let you live. Now, do you think he lets them live just because they have food? Or maybe they said, we'll give it to you. I see this as he takes a bribe. Don't kill us. We got stuff we can pay you off. Okay, you know, I'll let you live. Now, where are we going? Does Ishmael think I'm going to set up shop and I'm going to rule from Mizpah? Probably not. That's not his plan from the beginning. Plus, Nebuchadnezzar could come back and be angry. Okay, so we see in verse 10, we want to remember this. Ishmael carried away captive the rest of the people who were in Mizpah. So he killed the governor, killed the garrison. Now I'm taking these people off prisoner. Where? Back to Ammon. You know, it says he carried them over, departed to go to the Ammonites. And by the way, this is the verse where it mentions the king's daughters among those people. So there's a specific mention. We got unnamed people with king's daughters. And by the way, it's assumed that Jeremiah and Baruch are in this group as well. So now they're slaves. They're taking them to Ammon so they can sell them as slaves. It's certain that's what's going to happen. But it doesn't get there. Verse 11, Johanan, the son of Korea, and the captains of the forces that were with him heard of the evil that Ishmael did. Verse 12, they took all the men and went to fight Ishmael. They found him by the great pool that is in Gibeon. Oh yeah, that same pool, that's where we saw, was it the men who were following Abner fight with the men who were following Joab? That must be quite a pool. I wonder if it's still there. Anyways, they caught up with him. Now, the people that Ishmael took away captive, verse 12, they see Johanan and the people coming and they're glad, they're happy, we're saved. Verse 15, Ishmael escaped. Ishmael is a coward. He killed Gedaliah by deception. He fooled those other people, brought him in, and when they were off guard, then he killed them. And when some serious men come who can fight him, he runs and hides. Now, I'm calling him out. Of course, he's not here to challenge me to a fight, which is lucky for me. He'd probably kill me. But Ishmael is just a bad dude. There's nothing good about him in this. Johanan seems to have something good about him. He and these other leaders, basically, they care enough about the people of their country to go after them to try to save them. He frees the people and they're heading back, but they're still kind of afraid. So verse 16, it talks about how they recovered all the people, you know, the mighty men. Verse 17, they departed and dwelt in the habitation of Kimham, which is near Bethlehem on the way to Egypt. On their way to Egypt? Well, yeah, they've got this thought in mind. Maybe we got to get out of here. People are dying left and right. People are coming from Ammon to kill us and make us prisoner. Nebuchadnezzar's probably going to send back an army. Let's get out of here. Let's go to Egypt where we'll be nice and safe. That's an important thought. That habitation of Kimham, you haven't come across, well, no, I don't think so. You've just, in former prophets, you've got David as king, right? Well, I reference this because Kimham is sort of an obscure reference, but in 2 Samuel 19, he appears because there's a rich fella named Barzillai who helps David when he's on the run from Absalom. And David then offers Barzillai, come back with me, I'll take care of you. Perhaps even offering him a position in the government. And Barzillai says, I'm 80-something years old. I can't go to Jerusalem and, you know, do this. Let me go back home and die in my own city. But here's this young fella named Kimham. Why don't you go do something good for him? And David says, okay, whatever you want me to do, I'll take him. And we don't hear anything else about it. But here, hundreds of years later, we hear about this habitation or estate of Kimham. And I always interpret that as, hey, the young guy was given a chance and he made good. You know, he probably worked hard. He built up. He established an estate and it was known by his name generations later. I'd like to think that I would do that if I were given that opportunity. Okay, so next week we'll get into this and we'll sort of complete this narrative of these people on the run. Now, has it come across as a little bit confusing? I mean, it doesn't have to be, and it helps to, you know, reread it. But again, I'm going to try to backtrack and just give an overview of the story next week after we finish it in a way that I hope will help put it in our memories who went where and what happened. But we'll worry about that on Monday.